Live from York, this is The Late Late Show with Christopher Vowles on Teachers Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome. Tonight we're joined by anthropologist and psychologist Dr. Sheena Lev-Levy of the University of Durham to consider the theory and practice of teaching and learning in hunter-gatherer societies. So join us as we explore how the role of teacher and learner is understood, what teaching and learning look like in the Bayaka community.
Live from York, this is The Late Late Show with Christopher Vowles on Teachers Talk Radio. Tune in live on the Podbean app or desktop player. Just head over to www.podbean.com/lsw/ttradio or search Teachers Talk Radio. Follow the hashtag TTRadio.
And we'll also be exploring questions about how hunter-gatherer education might pose suggestions and new ways forward for Western theories of education. Well, hello everyone and welcome to the Sunday Late Show. This month you find me 3 days into my Easter holiday and having recently returned from a two-hour trip up the A1 motorway to a cold and blustery Northumberland, where I have been visiting Hadrian's Wall and the various Roman settlements associated with it. Friday afternoon saw a visit to the Sill Natural Landscape Discovery Centre in Northumberland National Park, an excellent environmental education centre located along seemingly endless empty roads in the heart of a landscape that embraces rugged upland, moorland, farmland and turbulent watercourses. The Sill's sympathetic and well-designed interpretation boards and educational installations present an accessible and compelling case for wider public engagement with the National Park's work to protect the fragile environment and the wildlife, people and cultures that depend upon it for their survival. This was followed with a visit to the extensive remains of the Roman fort and town at Vindolanda between Hexham and Carlisle, one highlight of which was reading some of the discarded tablet messages unearthed by the Vindolanders Trust's archaeologists. Among these messages, translated from their original Latin, were a detailed report of the garrison's troop numbers and various reasons for sickness absence, an invitation to a birthday party addressed from one woman to another, and an army officer's request that more beer be ordered for his thirsty men. Between the showers, in the buffeting wind, I was also able to walk the ruined streets of the fort, explore the foundations upon which an extravagant bathhouse once stood, the district in which the merchants sold their wares, and an altar dedicated to one of the many gods honoured by this once thriving multinational community. When the Romans arrived in foreign lands with the intention of absorbing their peoples into the expanding empire, they quickly shipped off the fighting men of the civilizations they defeated to serve Rome in distant and disparate settings. So Vindolanda predominantly hosted auxiliary soldiers, originally from regions that we now call France, Germany, Belgium, and the Netherlands. As Roman legions were exclusively composed of Roman citizens during Hadrian's time, these auxiliary cohorts were crucial in defending the empire's outer limits. So much so that auxiliaries stationed in Britannia are thought to have outnumbered legionaries by 2.5 times by the middle of the 2nd century AD. And I have to say it was very difficult indeed to imagine a Roman legionary in AD 130 cheerily leaving behind the Dolce Vita of the Roman Mediterranean to take up a posting in the distinctly wetter and chillier climes of northern Britannia, no matter how grand the bathhouse might be in his temporary home. Yesterday morning, however, I was quickly disabused of the notion that Hadrian's Wall had been predominantly populated by Romans, who had found a very practical reason for wearing woolen socks with their sandals, as the Roman Army Museum suggested that one was more likely to encounter a Syrian or a Gaul than a Roman legionary patrolling the wall for much of its active service. The museum also has a neat Roman classroom installation, where a life-size projection of a Roman teacher from Naples will teach you how to be a good citizen while furnishing you with some elementary Latin literacy and numeracy lessons. surrounded by the busts of Rome's leading philosophers, generals, and poets. Your instructor reassures you that teaching is no less worthy a career aspiration than a full-service military career, with the words scientia potentia est, or knowledge is power. I certainly left Northumberland possessing more knowledge than I had when I arrived on Friday afternoon, and it was pleasing to see just how much lottery fund money had been invested in establishing such a high-quality collection of public education centres in one of the most remote regions of northern England. In tonight's show, however, we are going to concern ourselves with the education practices employed by a community not so widely known as the Romans, and about whom comparatively little has been written. So we'll be asking, what might education look like in societies where reading and writing are not practiced by its members? What do the terms teacher and learner mean outside state-regulated education systems? And how are knowledge and skills passed down from one generation to the next in such contexts? This evening, then, we are exploring how education works in hunter-gatherer communities in the company of Dr. Sheena Levy, who has published extensively on this topic and others over the last decade. Having completed her PhD in psychology in 2019, Sheena uses methods from anthropology and psychology to conduct research into hunter-gatherer societies to understand the cultural diversity in and evolution of social learning in childhood. She is especially interested in questions about how and from whom children learn through meaningful participation in everyday activities. Since 2016, Sheena has been working with egalitarian Bayaka foragers and their farmer neighbours in the Congo Basin to conduct primary research into social learning practices. Sheena is currently assistant professor in the Department of Psychology at Durham University. And I'm delighted to say that Sheena joins us on the line now. Good evening to you, Sheena, and thank you for joining us on Teachers Talk Radio today.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. We can hear you nice and clear.
Great.
Perhaps we could begin, Sheena, by considering what the term hunter-gatherer societies might mean, as I suspect some might associate this phrase, perhaps, with media representations of the uncontacted tribes of the Amazon, or perhaps the inhabitants of the Andaman Islands. What do you understand hunter-gatherer societies to be, and what kind of misconceptions ought we to be aware of when discussing this term?
Awesome. That's a great question. First, thank you so much for having me, and thanks also to all your listeners for having me as well. So I think the term hunter-gatherer, when we use it kind of in everyday colloquially in everyday life, the term we are often, like you said, either talking about uncontacted communities, or more often than that, thinking about our evolutionary past. And it's true that throughout our evolutionary history, until the advent of agriculture, hunting and gathering was the main way we as humans made a living. But there are many, many hunter-gatherers alive and well today who don't who aren't our ancestors, they're contemporary people, who engage in lots of different ways with the nation states that they live in, and with farmer neighbors or with markets, some as day laborers, some as, you know, active members in market economies. And so for the most part, when we're talking about hunter-gatherer societies, we're talking about communities that either currently or in their recent history practiced those subsistence strategies. And I also think it's always exciting for me to remind myself that hunter-gatherers are very diverse in their subsistence practices, very diverse in the ecologies that they live in, and in some cases have transitioned to and from being hunters and gatherers in recent and not so recent history. So it's not kind of a fixed category. It overlaps with a lot of other ways of making a living. But nonetheless, we find that there are certain social features that tend to reoccur, specifically in terms of egalitarianism, a strong value on autonomy, and a strong value of sharing, not only of food, but also of goods and space and knowledge. And that's not every hunter-gatherer society. I'll also add that, because it always feels so romantic, right? We're talking about egalitarianism, but it's hard fought and hard won. So it's a lot of politics, a lot of negotiation to be an egalitarian, autonomous, sharing hunter-gatherer, right? And there's always a push and pull of trying to hide, trying to get a little bit more, and then lots of cultural ways in which that's pulled back.
And are there any continents presently where hunter-gatherer societies no longer exist?
No, there's hunter-gatherers on every continent. Yeah, every continent. In Europe, in the far north, in Greenland and northern Denmark, there are Inuit. And in North America, there are historically hunter-gatherers all over, and many First Nations or Native American, depending on if you're in Canada or the US, or Inuit communities continue to practice hunting and gathering for part of their livelihoods. All over Latin America, all over Africa, all over Asia, Australia, Oceania, there are hunter-gatherers everywhere.
So there's really ought to be something we ought to know a little bit more about, I think, and hopefully tonight's show will help us to explore some of these themes that you've already mentioned there, Sheena. Now, before you moved into your research into hunter-gatherer communities, I understand that you were also briefly involved in teaching American children out in the wilderness. I wonder if you'd like to tell us a little bit about that experience.
Yeah, absolutely. So in Quebec, where I'm from, we have something that's kind of like A-levels, but in content, but structurally a little bit closer to university. So it's like 2 years when you finish high school, secondary school, before you go to university. And after that, what we call CEGEP, but before going to university, I spent a couple years at a wilderness survival school in Washington State called Wilderness Awareness School. And for the first year of that program, I learned, you know, to make a light living, because what I learned in my research is it takes, you know, a long time to learn how to gather, and not just a year. So I moved out to the country for the first time, because I'm from a city, I'm from Montreal. And I spent a year in really close connection with a group of 30 other adults, being, you know, in community, making fires, collecting food, you know, getting into arguments, making up, like really living in a very intimate way. And then the second year of the program, we were apprentices for a youth program where kids between the ages of 13 and 18, all on different days, would come and hang out with us. And I apprenticed for the preschool program and the high school program. And just got to hang out with kids in the woods and learn from them and share knowledge with them. And it was a really, really fun, a fun way to spend, you know, my early adulthood before going to university.
And does the wilderness education movement take some of its pointers from what we know about hunter-gatherer communities?
Yeah, absolutely. So a big thread of the Wilderness Awareness School and similar schools is this push to reconnect with the natural world and to feel, you know, a sense of place and an emotional connection with the natural world, especially through practice. So through going out and collecting food and building shelters and making friction fires, you get to know the environment, because there actually is a difference between trying to make a friction fire with a cedar wood versus oak, right? So then that knowledge becomes very embodied, if you will, and very kind of present in your mind. And a lot of those skills are drawn from the anthropological literature and from research with hunter-gatherers. And also the structure of the school also draws very much from research with hunter-gatherers. So the kids are in multi-age groups. So all the early childhood kids are together, the middle childhood kids are together, and the adolescents are together. So the adolescents, it was like 12 or 13 to 17. And a lot of the pedagogy around that, draws directly from the anthropological literature on hunter-gatherer society specifically.
So what do teaching and learning look like in a typical wilderness camp day?
So we have, we had a rule called the 50-50 rule. So we would plan 50% of the day and then have, you know, let kind of things emerge for the other 50%. And usually the kids would show up and we would do what we called invisible school. So the educators would be engaged in an activity. So somebody might be weaving a basket, somebody else might be making, you know, a tincture or making some tea. And then when the kids would arrive, they'd kind of have the chance to go and join whatever activity that they wanted. And then we'd have some core routines, like, you know, just classic mindfulness things like giving thanks, checking in with our bodies and our senses, sitting in the woods, you know, it increases with time, but with the goal of being 20 minutes a day, to just be aware of our environment and our surroundings and again, feeling that sense of home and place and intimacy. With the environment. And then we'd have, you know, games, usually some crafts, usually a wander, those types of things. And then a lot of storytelling throughout the day as well.
And how do the children respond to this experience? Were many of them city dwellers themselves?
It was pretty mixed. Some who lived in Seattle, some who lived in Vancouver, both the Vancouver in Canada and the Vancouver in the US, some who lived in the country, some who went to school and took one day out to join the programs, and some who didn't go to school at all. And, you know, a full gamut of experiences in between. And I think the thing that that really struck me is how much of a sense of responsibility the kids had for each other. So the older kids would, you know, help support and guide the younger kids who are newer to the program, or who are just, you know, still learning either physically or cognitively to do some of the skills. So there's a lot of peer teaching and scaffolding from one kid to another. And one of the outcomes of that is that that sense of responsibility, I feel like, I haven't done research on this, right? But really reduce the kind of bullying that we see in same age classrooms. Like, because you have a sense of responsibility towards the younger kids in your class or the other kids in your class, that's a way to express that aspect of being a kid with other kids. And it's also just really cool to watch the kids challenge themselves and grow in themselves as they gain different skills and practice different things. And, you know, some kids would really want to learn to do something like make a friction fire, and they'd be really focused on that. And, you know, in a couple months, they'd figure out how to do it. And that sense of pride and following your passions and trying to learn to do something and accomplishing it is really cool to see kids do that.
And did you observe any particular situations whereby conflict resolution was required amongst these children?
Yeah, there's a lot of work around communication and conflict resolution. And part of that was really preemptive. So there's a lot of opportunities for talking, for working things out. A lot of like community guidelines and rules were developed collaboratively between the kids, obviously more so for the older kids than the younger kids. But there were some baseline rules that, you know, were emphasized and brought back and reminded. And the kids really took that on as well. And that doing that front work, like deciding what are the rules we're going to follow as a group and how are we going to respect each other and what might that look like, and asking and probing questions and that type of stuff, really reduced the need for conflict resolution later on. So when a conflict did come up, Which of course it did, right? You take teenagers on, you know, a 5-day camping excursion, where, you know, you might not get a lot of food and you have to solve problems. But that the upshot of that is that the kids already had all the tools necessary for solving those problems. So they were amazing communicators, amazing at making their needs known, at finding solutions together of how to solve problems, that kind of thing.
And how do they cope with the potential challenges of insufficient resources when they needed them?
Yeah, maybe I should say, like, it was always self-choice. So it wasn't like, it was never like a punishment or something like that. Like, there's a documentary on Netflix right now about these types of, this wasn't like a kind of correctional kind of program. These were kids who, you know, choose to go on these adventures for a few days. And we were very mindful of their well-being. And if there was loads of emergency food should they need or should they want, kind of thing. But they coped really well. And I think it gives you a real sense of gratitude when you're in those low resource settings for a few days, not only of how lucky we are to have everything that we have, but actually how strong our bodies are and how strong our minds are and being able to cope with those types of challenges.
And how did they decide how to spend the time that wasn't structured for them?
Luckily, when you're in a natural environment, there's a lot that is happening around you all the time, you know? So, and the adults kind of took that on as well. Like us as apprentices, like we had a lot of training on off days where we were together and we would fill our time with the same things that the kids would be doing. So, you know, you'd follow a set of tracks and then that would take you to a pond where you would see a fish and then that would, and then you'd, you know, see an eagle swoop down and get, so you're just following the kind of things that are happening in front of you. And through doing that, you're learning and generalizing the world around you. So I remember my friend Ross and I really wanted to learn to hunt, and bullfrogs are an invasive species in that environment. So there's no rules around hunting bullfrogs, and they get big, like the bullfrogs get huge. And all my friends were much better at hunting bullfrogs than me. But my friend Ross and I decided to go and find some bullfrogs. You know, you find a croak, we stalked a bullfrog crawling after it, and it jumped into a hole. And you know, this was like a couple hours that we spend as 20 year olds, and we grabbed a stick and we stuck it in the hole, and the bullfrog popped out of the hole and jumped into my lap. It was the most amazing experience, and it was a nice little dinner for the community. And again, these are invasive species, so there's no harm at all in taking them out of the environment. And it was just a really magical experience, and one, you know, 15 years later, I still think about pretty regularly. So that kind of setting yourself a challenge and following through and, you know, just going with what's given to you makes a 50% of unscheduled time actually very scheduled. You're just not the one kind of building the schedule.
Yeah, nature has its own timetable, isn't
it? Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
And how... I mean, that's a very good example, actually, hunting in the wilderness, the sense in which children gradually learn to become aware of these things that happen in nature, the fact that some animals kill other animals to eat them.
Right. Yeah.
It's something I've experienced, too, with spending a lot of time with birds of prey and my 8-year-old daughter, and having to initially explain what the little yellow chick looking thing was in the falconer's hand. And I had to confirm, well, actually, yes, it was a chick, because her favorite friend, the eagle, actually eats them. So there's that sense in which nature isn't all roses, cuddly, fluffy bunnies and the rest of it. There's a kind of rawness there too, isn't there?
Absolutely. And I think it's a really nice, like that example about the chick. So, you know, in kind of Western style, and there's a lot of, I think in the UK, you call them progressive schools that have a different structure. But in the kind of more like standard classic Western school, you start with general rules and then you get specific from there. But actually, when you're out in nature, you start with the specifics and then you abstract from there, right? So you see a chick in the beak, and you might see a different thing in the beak. Okay, so eagles also eat, like they eat baby birds, but they might also eat rodents. So then you start making general rules from there of what the ecology and the behavior of that species is from those specific firsthand experiences.
Yeah, I can imagine the pyramid of biomass is like to stick with you at a younger age when you see it in practice.
Yeah, totally.
Rather than sitting in the biology lab drawing up diagrams from textbooks.
Yeah.
So what other aspects of the environment did you notice that learners became more aware of once they moved into these wilderness camp settings?
Yeah, I mean, kids all over the place are super fascinated with bugs and birds. Right now, my almost four-year-old, he's into birds, and we have one of those bird books with buttons so he can play the different bird songs that matches the pictures. And also some plant species, like especially berry bushes, are always really exciting for kids. And it's really fun to watch kids figure things out. We just got an allotment plot, which is that's a real survival of the fittest to get in the UK right now, a plot. And we were lucky enough to get one. And so we're digging up the soil. And my husband was digging with a shovel, and every single worm, my kid was like, oh, a worm. Oh, that's a big worm. Oh, that's a small worm. What do the worms do? You know, and we're having these conversations about worms, and then we're talking about woodlouse and snails, and you know, what do they eat and what do they do and how they make soil. So kids, because they're small and they're close to the ground, right, they're noticing all these things that are for adults very much below our eye line, below what we see, below what we notice. And they're keeping track of all these creepy crawlies, all these little species, and what they're doing. And it makes, you know, when you're talking about pyramids, right, they're starting at the bottom. And part of it is kids are small, right? They're a lot closer. It's a lot easier to see those things from that angle. And what I always find really interesting is that a lot of those species, bugs, frogs, birds, they tend to be indicator species. They're species that tell us about the health of the environment. They tell us about climate change, right? Frogs singing, for example, will tell you when spring starts, or birdsong will be the same. An environment where there's not a lot of bugs also tells you a lot about that environment as well. So I'm always fascinated by what my son is noticing, because what he's noticing and what he's not noticing tells us a lot about the quality of the environment, about changes in the environment, stuff like that.
And what things is he noticing as he goes to the allotment regularly?
Right now, because the allotment is very bare, we're noticing a lot of worms. That's the main thing, worms, which is a good sign because we have healthy soil. And we also have a worm bin that we've been keeping since he was little. So he knows already, he's seen the whole process of how worms eat our food scraps and poop out the worm casting, which we add to our garden, kind of thing. So he's paying attention to all of that really, really closely, which is a lot of fun to watch. And just having a chat about what foods he wants to grow. And we have a little garden out front too. And every day we go out and we look at how things are growing and if things are growing yet. So he's getting a sense of the kind of rhythms. And I find it stressful because I'm I'm ready for everything to grow. But for him, he doesn't have those expectations yet. So he's a lot more patient than I am in that respect.
As you noticed too, that the allotment associations in England tend to be made up of the community elders.
So we haven't seen anybody yet at our allotment plot. We've only been a couple times. We've got some potatoes chitting on our windowsill, but we've only just been to the allotment a couple times. He has learnt about stinging nettle the hard way both times that he's been at the allotment. But we're looking forward to some allotment parties in the summer. And I think it'll be a really nice opportunity to get to know the community a little bit more, and a big reason why we also joined the allotment too.
Well, thank you, Sheena, for setting out what we might understand hunter-gatherer societies to be, and for describing your early experiences with wilderness education in the American outdoors, and indeed your experiences on the local allotment with your own child. It's amazing, isn't it, how much attention you suddenly start to pay to the small things your children do.
Absolutely.
When you have any kind of connection with education at all.
Yeah, for sure.
In the next section of the show, we'll explore how teaching and learning operate in the specific hunter-gatherer society with which you have worked, and consider how such an approach to education supports the development of learners to meet the challenges that they will encounter as they move from childhood to adulthood. And we'll be right back after this.
This show is brought to you in partnership with John Catt Educational, publishing professional development books and resources to support great teaching and learning in schools around the world. Have you checked out their latest releases? Use the code JCTTR2324 for 20% off your order. Don't miss out. Visit johncattbookshop.com to explore their full range of titles and advance your own professional development today. Happy reading.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and this is Teachers Talk Radio News.
The BBC News website features a long read on the topic of school buildings and fears that some schools will miss out on a rebuild. The last places on a scheme to rebuild schools in England are reported to have gone to schools with issues caused by reinforced autoclaved aerated concrete, or RAC. This has left some school leaders frustrated and unions accusing the government of cutting corners by using existing schemes to deal with a new problem. The government says it has invested £15 billion in school buildings since 2015, and the School Rebuildings Programme, known as SRP, aims to rebuild or refurbish 500 schools in a decade. The first 99 were selected by the DfE in 2021, having been identified as in the worst condition. Local authorities and school trusts were then invited to nominate schools in 2022. Around 300 schools were successful. 797 schools were rejected but hoped to be chosen in subsequent selection rounds. However, for many, they were disappointed not to be named in the final list of 110 schools. In recent months, it has emerged that 106 out of the 110 have been affected by RAC. Headteachers leading in crumbling, ageing buildings are disappointed. They are coping with leaking roofs, temporary buildings and plumbing issues. The article reports on three schools from across England who have all missed out. In Northern Ireland, unions representing further education lecturers have voted to reject what they describe as an insulting pay offer. Members of the UCU and the NASUWT have been offered a 5% increase plus an unconsolidated payment of £1,500. Both unions have called on the Economy Minister to engage with them to close an education pay gap. Earlier this month, there was a formal offer on school teachers' pay, but union leaders say that in FE, staff have watched the pay gap widen for far too long. The NASUWT's General Secretary, Dr. Patrick Roach, said FE lecturers in Northern Ireland are fed up with being treated as second-class teachers. FE Week also reports on the sector, with an article focusing on the government's plan for a new advanced British standard qualification. College membership bodies and school leaders' unions have released responses to the government consultation on the proposal, which closed last week. The plan was announced by Rishi Sunak last year, that the ABS would replace T-levels and A-levels in around 10 years' time, although an upcoming election may change all this. Both the NAHT and ASCL have released their responses, focusing on concerns that the new proposals are clunky and that they undermine the parity of esteem between academic and technical education, and that without investment in recruitment are also unworkable. Under the plan, students would study a set of subject majors and minors, with all required to study English and maths to the age of 18. Unions also warned against considering reform in isolation, and that it should be considered as part of a whole, from EYFS to Key Stage 5. Full details can be found on the FE Week website, whilst a similar article in the TES focuses on comments by Exam Board OCR due to concerns of teacher recruitment and school space needed to deliver ABS. OCR says that there are opportunities for change, but that it disagrees with government proposals. It also expressed the view that the A-level name should be kept due to its strong and growing international reputation. For further analysis, you can read more on the TES magazine website. Finally, student loans are in the news again after an FOI request from the BBC revealed the highest outstanding student debt is more than £230,000. The figures also reveal that another loan holder has accumulated nearly £55,000 worth of interest. The student loans company says graduates in England leave university with an average debt of just under £45,000. The FOI request was for details of the highest amount of student debt owed for each of the five student loan plans on offer. The amount graduates repay and the length of the loan vary from plan to plan and depend on when and where they went to university and their degree type. The figures have sparked debate again amongst many students, graduates and others. It's almost 15 years since tuition fees were tripled in England. Fees now cost a maximum of £9,250 in England. Debts are written off at the end of loan terms, but this is usually after 30 years. The student loans company processes around 1.5 million loan applications per year. A spokesperson for the website Save the Student described the high figures for outstanding debt as eye-watering. And the NUS said the system discourages people from working-class backgrounds from going to university. The Department for Education said its reforms mean no graduate will pay back more than they borrowed when inflation is taken into account. This has been your Teachers Talk Radio News with Joe Fox.
Welcome back to our show on hunter-gatherer education practices with Dr. Sheena Levy of Durham University. In the first section of the show, we explored what is meant by hunter-gatherer society and learnt about Sheena's early experiences as a wilderness camp leader in America. Now I'd like us to explore what it was that drew you to the study of hunter-gatherer communities in particular, rather than, say, some of the alternative education philosophies closer to home, Sheena. So what prompted you to focus your research on hunter-gatherer communities and on the Bayaka community in particular?
So I studied anthropology for my undergrad, and it was an opportunity for me to see if a lot of the things that we were, you know, being taught in very general layperson's term at this wilderness school were true or, you know, nuanced, and to kind of nuance that information. And while I was, you know, doing this undergraduate course, I came across this book called Hunter-Gatherer Childhoods, edited by Barry Hewlett and Michael Lamb. And I was like, this is it. This is the book. This is what I've been after. And that's when I learned a little bit more about evolutionary anthropology and more the quantitative side of anthropology and what I ended up doing my master's in. And then ended up actually doing my PhD in developmental psychology with Michael Lamb. And he had some contacts who were working with Bayaka and setting up a project with Bayaka. So I was able to tag along as a research assistant first, and then doing my PhD field work. So through a bunch of happy accidents, French is my first language, and the Republic of the Congo is a French-speaking country. So it was useful that I spoke French. And Bayaka speak a Bantu language, and I'd taken Swahili in my undergrad, so I had some, not in the same language, but kind of structural understanding of how the language works, so I was able to pick it up, and I'm by no means fluent, but conversational. So I ended up spending, I think in total now, I've spent 16 months since 2016 with Bayaka, and they've welcomed me and taken care of me because I need a lot of taking care of. It's been a really lovely experience to be with them, both in the village and in the forest, and mostly hanging out with kids and trying to learn the way that they learn.
And what has your research entailed, Sheena? How do you collect the information, the data that you're looking for to support you in your endeavors?
So we use a lot of different methods. The main method that I employ is what we call structured observations. And so the main thing that I do is I follow kids around with a timer and I write down what they're doing every minute with a specific coding scheme that we developed specifically for the study of how kids learn in the Congo Basin. So I just, you know, have my clipboard, I have an interpreter who comes with me and translates everything that the kids are saying. And I just usually will pick one kid at random and get their consent and obviously their parents' consent before that, to make sure they're okay with me hanging out with them. And then I'll just follow them and do what they do. Sometimes hang around camp, sometimes, you know, go do some dishes or go deeper into the forest and just keep track of who they're with and what they're doing and how they're learning. So that's my main method. And then we'll also do some experiments. And I should say, I work with a team of people. So I have amazing colleagues, Adam Boyette, who's at the Max Planck Institute, my colleague Sarah Pope, who I work very closely with as well, Hanel Jang, Vidrich Kanza. I could go on. I mean, I just have the most amazing colleagues, and we all work in different villages, but have overlapped in those villages as well. And, you know, so that's what I'm talking about when I say we. We've done some experiments. Importantly, we try and either modify experiments so that they're reflecting the local context, because of course, experiments are a very funny thing, right? They're designed by people who have many, 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 many years of schooling. And they're piloted with kids who also have many years of schooling and who are very comfortable in these kind of contrived scenarios, right? Because they take tests and they have assignments and have stuff like that. And are used to also adults asking them questions that obviously the adults know the answer to. In for the BIOCA kids that I work with, that's not natural and that's not part of their learning ecology at all. So we try and modify experiments to make them a little bit more comfortable and a little bit more natural, or use experiments in tandem with things like behavioral observations to show that the experiments are actually not measuring what we think they're measuring. So Sarah and I did one experiment, which is a very classic experiment for measuring tool innovation. And so what's a very classic thing is that you give kids a straight pipe cleaner and a long tube with a candy in a basket at the bottom of the tube, and you ask kids, can you get the tube? Can you get the candy out or the sticker or whatever prize is at the bottom? And so to solve that problem, you have to take that straight pipe cleaner and bend it into a hook and fish it out. And kids are not very good at doing that until the age of 8. And there's a lot of research into why that is. And this experiment has been exported to these other communities to ask whether this is a universal thing. And we found that BIOCA kids are also not very good at innovating with pipe cleaners in this very strange task. But when you give kids pipe cleaners and let them play in a natural way, then they actually invent all kinds of cool things. So that's like an example of some of the methods that we do. And then we also spend a lot of time talking to parents about why they parent the way that they do and the kind of cultural decisions that they make about granting autonomy or not and granting freedom and learning or not, to try and understand their point of views as well. So a lot of different things. Since we're out there for a lot of, you know, time, we're not coming home in the evening when we're in the field, right? So we try to maximize the types of data we collect while we're there.
And do you notice any differences between the villages within the same community?
Yeah, that's a good question. There's BIOCA. I mean, there's so many BIOCA just in the region where we work, probably 100,000. There's definitely differences in the natural environment, micro differences with big impacts. There are differences in language. I'm not so sure there are huge differences in child rearing and learning, but we haven't quite, or each of us has a very different approach and different research questions that we're pursuing. So it would be really cool to do the same research at each place and see if we're noticing big differences. For sure, one big difference is that not all villages have schools. Some villages have only primary schools and no secondary schools. Some villages have both. So that is you know, a difference in for sure in how kids learn in those different villages.
Yeah, I just wonder if you get the similar differences that you get in Western education, where school X does things in a certain way and school Y does things in a different way. I mean, we have that alone in rural North Yorkshire. So I wonder how it translates across to that context.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one thing that we do find is that just the size of the community will impact learning. So kids in smaller camps tend to, just because they can't really assort by age or by gender, they tend to play in more mixed groups, and that leads to less competitive play, right? It's not that fun to play soccer, like 3-year-old versus a 17-year-old, right? So the games that they play tend to be more competitive, more cooperative rather, and a lot less kind of rules. And then in the bigger camps or bigger villages, the more you get those divisions and the more you get a little bit more competitive play, not much, but a little bit more competitive play. So we do see differences in that aspect of socio-ecology.
So what does daily life look like for a member of the Boyaka community then?
Yeah, so kids will get up in the morning, have a little bit of food, warm up by the fire. One of my first things, the first thing that happens is kids are sent to get coals from other people's fire. So you see this kind of a chilly kid, you know, in a sweater, like running to their neighbor's house or to their aunt's house or something to get a coal. And then once people are warmed up and have their bellies full, women and men will either go off into the forest to collect food, either together or separately, or hang around camp or the village doing some crafting, you know, fixing baskets, that kind of thing, or will engage in either trade or wage labor for neighboring farmers. And the kids are kind of free to either join in those activities, or what happens more often is the kids will peel off in their own group and go collect their own resources. So they'll kind of get together and it be a consensus, kind of make some decisions about what they want to collect, and then they'll go out into the bush, sometimes really far, and go out and collect food. And so one fruit which they love to collect, for example, is called maondo. It's grows on rubber vines, and it's almost like looks like an orange on the outside. It's nothing like an orange on the inside. And kids will climb up. The older kids will climb up really, really high up in the trees, and just drop all of these fruits, and the younger kids will go and pick them up. And what's nice about rubber vines too is when you're up there, you can make a little slit in the rubber vine and actually collect rubber. And what the kids will do is they'll make kind of a paste on their bellies when they're up there. It's a nice place to store a sticky substance, right? And not a lot of hair, so you don't get that waxing effect. And then when they come down and the rubber has dried a little bit, they'll make a ball. And then they'll play, so they'll make their own rubber balls. Or they, sometimes will also make the strap for a slingshot. And so they'll either have a ball game or go out and hunt songbirds. So these activities kind of build on each other. Another activity that's very popular is swinging on a liana swing. So they'll fell one of these either rubber vines or different types of vines in the forest and make a kind of swing and push each other and kind of go, you know, as far up as they can. And it's a really, it really builds trust in each other, but also in the forest as well. It's quite a very cool thing to watch the kids do that.
And when you say they play ball games, are they aware of the world football obsession that goes on? So are they bringing ideas from the general world into their own community as well?
Absolutely. So in a lot of ways. So first, we as researchers, we bring a lot of gear and a lot of stuff. So one of the things I loved with the kids, you know, I'd call home every day with a satellite phone, and the kids started playing telephone and pretending that these kind of forest fruit were phones, which I thought was hilarious. So they'd sit on this tree and pretend to call each other. There's a logging road not too far away. I mean, it's still quite a trek to get there, but some of the kids have seen that. So they'll pretend to ride trucks on fallen trees because it's quite bouncy, like they assume a truck to be. When I was in 2018, there was an Ebola outbreak in DRC, in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. So not at all where I work. But obviously the news had somehow gotten there. Even there's no road, there's no network connectivity. And instead of playing tag, the kids were playing Ebola. So they were running after each other and spreading cooties, basically. So they really know what's going on in the world. And when I was there last summer, so I had my baby during COVID, which was not a planned COVID baby. We got pregnant right before the outbreak of COVID. And so we felt quite isolated, as did everybody else, of course. And people in the village were coming up to me and they were saying, you know, we were really thinking about all of you in Europe over there with the disease that was getting you all. And it was, I actually burst into tears because I kind of hadn't metabolized how hard it had been. And here I am in this village, and every morning when I go to wash, I say hi to about 50 people, right? Say good morning, walk down to the river, and then walk back a different way and say hi to another 50 people. So you are living life in the virtual opposite of what it was like in COVID lockdown, right? And it actually, it made me cry because there's so many beautiful traditions around childbirth, especially, and traditions of bringing food and a lying in period for between 3 months and a year. Where women will stay home with their babies and people bring them food and help take care of the babies. And so, yeah, it was quite emotional. So, yeah, everybody knows what's going on in the world. and they're pretty cued in. And, oh, they love Jackie Chan. That's the other. They love karate and stuff like that, too. And the boys, whenever we take pictures of them, they're always doing karate moves. So, yeah, they're very cued into what's going on in the world.
And is there a view at what age children cease to be babies and toddlers and start to be kind of community learners?
They're community learners really from the time that they're born. So in this community, infants are passed around, have many, many what we call allo parents. So parents that aren't the mother or father who take care of them. I think in one statistic, I might be wrong, but it was infants were being passed from one person to another 14 times an hour, I want to say, in a study by Barry Hewlett. So kids are, from infancy, being attached to many people, watching many people do what they do. By the time they're 2, 3, 4, that's when they really join the peer group in an official way and like are really... Adults are a little bit more relaxed with kids going out and being with other kids. The kids themselves are a little bit less fragile. And that's when they really have the chance to be like fully self-initiated learners, just because they're more mobile and can take care of themselves a little bit more. And that's when they really start hanging out with other kids a lot more and kind of running around, playing games and doing their own thing.
And when they're not playing games and out enjoying themselves or out working with the older members of the community looking for food, how do teaching and learning operate in the community?
So there's also a lot of storytelling and also just overhearing of conversations. Not all stories are like these big epic stories about the past or about myths, right? A lot of stories is just people recounting their days. And there's also a lot of stories that happen on the land as well. So when kids are out, we'll pass, you know, we're out in the bush, we pass abandoned camps, and they'll tell stories of the people who stayed there once and the things that happened there. So the environment is full of social information as long as somebody's there to tell it to you, right? In the evening, a lot of storytelling, a lot of hanging out, and a lot of forest spirit plays. So these forest spirits that are captured and then are performed by the community. And that's also a big part of community activities, which involves initiation and performances that I am a mere spectator at. But that seems to be also a very important part of growing up and learning through song, through storytelling, through community activities, how to behave in these more religious aspects of life as well.
So does religion play a significant role in the community?
It does. The thing about religion and those types of spiritual beliefs is that it's very much a kind of separate layer. So people aren't talking about it all the time, but they're practicing it. So things as minor as spitting into a leaf and tucking it on a trail when a hunter goes for good luck, right? That's something that you might notice out of the corner of your eye, but it's not until you start asking questions and probing that you might understand. But kids from a very young age, they have their own forest spirits that they tend to and that they're initiated in, which are only for kids. So that's a really nice segue into the adult world as well, but also into kids having their own autonomy and their own forest spirits and their own cosmological understanding of the world as well. And same thing with like the music that you sing to the forest spirits opens the forest to get, and then if the forest is happy with your song, then it provides you with food. So for Bayaka, the relationship is very reciprocal with the forest. You feed the forest music and the forest feeds you resources. So it's, and you know, sometimes it's fraught. Like, again, it's not all, you know, this rosy picture. Sometimes if you don't share properly or you don't engage properly or you don't respect the taboos, then the forest closes and then you have to do certain things to open it up again. And I've seen a lot of those negotiations, figuring out what's happened, what social norms were broken, what relationships were broken, how do we fix it, what practices do we need to do both amongst ourselves in a community or with the forest to have those things open up again. So these are things that are constantly on people's minds and that are really important to keep resources flowing in both directions.
That's really interesting, actually. Quite a nice idea that they have this kind of almost like a guardian spirit walking alongside them into adulthood. Really quite powerful idea.
Yeah, I wouldn't call it quite a guardian spirit because it's a forest spirit it's more collectively held and was captured either by somebody themselves or maybe captured isn't even the right word there, but that's how I translate in my head. But of course, not all words have a one-to-one, maybe let's say tended. And then the kids, it's not so much walking alongside them, but an individual will transform into that forest spirit and then be kind of ushered by other kids within the community, or it's the same kind of structure for the adults. So it's, and forest spirits can get you. So there's one forest spirit that if you're a woman and it touches you, you can become infertile if you don't pay the right, do the right things to right that wrong. So forest spirits can be very contentious and very scary, and young kids can be very scared of the forest spirits as a result of that too.
Okay, so perhaps a more complex relationship
than
very I was thinking.
Yeah. Yeah.
And as you've been following these various children about in their day-to-day activities, what teaching strategies have you witnessed in action that they've been asked to develop or practice or rehearse?
Yeah, so I mean, the best illustration I have of this, but I've seen it so much. So this dad in the community found this honey right on the edge of the camp where we were living. And so he cut down this very tall tree, which had honey at the top, which is actually really important for the ecosystem because it opens up the forest to secondary growth. So cutting down these really old trees can be really good as long as it's done in a careful way. And so all the kids were out collecting honey. And then for like 2 weeks, the kids were like, let's go climb trees. Let's cut down trees. Obviously not as tall trees, but especially these three boys would go out and they would find a machete laying around. They were maybe 8 or 9 years old. And they would find these machetes and they, you know, grab them before somebody could say no. And go into this area of like kind of short, you know, secondary forest right on the outskirts of camp. and they would cut these notches the way that the adults cut notches to climb trees, and they would get these vines and tie them in a specific way as a harness around their waist, which is how the adults do it, and put the machete in the crook of their neck between their head and the shoulder to hold it as they're climbing up. And they would have the most amazing conversations, like, do it like this, no, a little bit more, watch out for that, how did he do it? And they would work out together, like reproducing what they had observed this adult man do when collecting honey. And they would go up and they would do this like for hours at a time, like up a tree, down a tree, next tree, up a tree, down a tree, cut it down, you know, and just figuring out, telling each other, reminding each other, asking each other questions, encouraging each other, just constantly this back and forth of teaching each other how to do these skills. And through this problem solving, like, we're really able to recreate all these, you know, it's really life or death, like making those knots right, picking the right vine that's going to actually hold the weight of your body, making the notch of the, you know, to put your foot in the right way. And also a physical skill of climbing these trees is not easy, right? And your feet need to go in the right place and, you know, be strong enough. Your arms, like your whole body is involved in this. And so by working these things out together, the kids were able to reproduce this in a very high fidelity way, and were able to climb up pretty high. I mean, it's not as high as the adults were going, but pretty high, and get up there and cut the tops of the trees and figure out which direction it was going to fall, right? So it was a really cool experience to watch them do that. And they just got so excited about this and did it until phased out and another activity kind of took the fore. And then there they went again, figuring things out, either traps or fishing or all these kinds of activities themselves. Yeah. So a lot of teaching, a lot of peer teaching, especially happening throughout the day constantly.
So as children get older, then, is there a particular set of skills they're expected to master, or is there an expectation in the community that some children will acquire skills in one particular specialist area while others might focus their efforts elsewhere?
Absolutely. So I think there's a kind of general knowledge that everybody seems to have, and just like how to make a living in the forest. And there are definitely people who are much better at certain aspects of it. So everybody knows how to weave a basket, but some people weave really beautiful, sturdy baskets, right? And then there are some skills that are only specialist skills, which will be a kind of more of an initiation. So being the guardian of a forest spirit would be one. Being a medicine person, an Nganga, which is kind of close to a shaman, in practice, that would be another one. Certain types of more medicinal healing for like everyday ailments, that seems to be more in the realm of women. Midwives, that's another skill. You know, everybody knows how to help, but some people have more of that specialized knowledge. So those tend to be the specialized skills. But again, anybody can have access to it with the right kind of access fee, if you will, access gift, and pursuing the right teacher. But a lot of people won't have any of those special skills as well. They might be amazing hunters or you know, just really good at making a living in their community. So there's no pressure on the kids to follow one thing over another. I think if your dad is a good healer, good hunter, you just have more access to that knowledge. So you might have more opportunities to pick up that skill, but it's not necessarily a given that you will be that you'll choose to do that. Another really important role actually is a spokesperson. So each camp will have a spokesperson, and that spokesperson will often give speeches in the morning or in the evening. And we'll also be the person to welcome people when they guests or newcomers when they come into camp. And they're the person that I will check in with regularly throughout my research to make sure that I'm not overstepping anything, or if I have specific questions about something that I've seen, that kind of thing. And that seems to be something that's very much based on the individual ability to be good with other people, to enforce norms without overstepping. To be a good politician, if you will, but not in a dictatorial way at all, because people can just leave camp if they don't like how you're acting, right? So you really need to keep the relations good with the people that you live with.
Okay, so certainly a sense of the emotional intelligence that's required for that kind
Absolutely.
Of role is important,
yeah.
isn't it?
Yeah, very much so.
How important is the development of learner flexibility generally when skills or knowledge need to be applied in unpredictable or hazardous circumstances? So are learners as good at responding to a problem in a novel scenario, or is
yeah.
that something that requires work?
Yeah, no, the kids are amazing at responding to new things. And the kids pick up on things so quickly. I mean, there's a couple kids, I would call them my little research assistants, because I would do something once and then they would go off and do it 20 times. Like, they'd figured out what I was after, right? And they would like go and ask 20 people that same question and report back to me like I hadn't asked them to do it, right? So the kids are really flexible. They're really quick on their feet. They understand how things work. Like setting up camp is a great example. So like I get to a camp, I've got a tent to set up, all this stuff. And within a few minutes, the kids have figured out, never having seen a tent before, how it works. And that's really important in this environment where resources are fluctuating, you know, throughout the year. Something might be in season and then it's no longer in season, where things are also like heterogeneously distributed in space. Where, you know, there's one part of the environment where you might get a lot of tubers and not in another. And so kids are good at recognizing those ecological features very quickly. And also where, you know, there can be a random year where all of a sudden there's no caterpillars and you don't know why. And then you have to pivot and find another resource to collect. So the kids are really, really clever. And then also socially, right? People are constantly coming and going. You know, somebody might move in for a few days, somebody might move in for a few weeks, people get married, their in-laws come, like, so there's a lot of social movement that's happening, and you have to learn to be comfortable with a lot of different people. And so the kids are really quick on their feet, are really flexible, figure things out really quickly, and they have to in that social and ecological environment. And some of the features of how they learn really contributes to that, right? Play is, the kids are constantly playing. Even when they're working, they're playing. And that gives them a chance to rehearse different types of behavior, figure things out as they go. There's some examples in the literature of like teenagers reenacting this fight that they'd seen in a village but resolving in a different way. So it gives them an opportunity to try out different solutions with no negative consequences, right? And so it contributes to that cognitive flexibility. Learning with other kids, there's research in education that shows that it gives kids actually an opportunity to develop new knowledge. If both kids have incomplete knowledge, then by combining their knowledge together, they actually both produce new knowledge that neither of them had. So that contributes to their learning, an opportunity also to, with the materiality of things. I was watching this teenage girl, weaving a mat, and her aunt came up and was like, "Oh, you did it." And the girl was like, "Leave me alone. Don't tell me how to do it. Like, just let me go." And the aunt left. And then the girl went and looked herself at the weaving pattern of her aunt's mat and then reverse engineered how to figure it out. So that type of learning where you see a finished product and have to reverse engineer how to get to that finished product, that seems to also contribute to cognitive flexibility and your ability to problem solve as well. So yeah, the kids are super flexible and they're just super quick on their feet. And even the teachers at school, for the kids who do go to school, they'll say like, "Oh, the Bayaka kids are so clever," and they'll attribute it to eating honey. The kids eat a lot of honey. So they'll say, "Oh, honey really makes you smart." That's why the kids are so smart. So there's a lot going on, and the food they eat is great too, right? So there's a lot going on, but yeah, the way that they learn really contributes to that flexibility. And of course, when you're self-motivated and the only kind of benchmark is yourself, can I push a little bit further? Can I do that little bit more, right? That's going to just make the learning be so much more self-motivated that you have a lot more willingness to stay with the problem than when it's extrinsically motivated as well.
Yeah, there certainly seems to be a sense that if you've got the agency within the process, then
yeah,
you're more likely to engage with what's put in front of you. Have you found any evidence in your research of special educational needs, as we would term them in the UK, manifesting in the education of the children that you've observed?
Not too much, to be honest. I think there's so much openness to interpersonal variation and diversity, and so little pressure to conform. And we find that over and over again in this research because there's such a high value in individual autonomy. So there's a lot of variation in norms, a lot of variation in how people think others should behave, a lot of variation in skill. So there's because it's so not cookie cutter, right? And there's so few benchmarks or specific milestones that are required to be met. There's really no reason why anybody couldn't thrive in that community. So we've not done a lot of research on that topic, but anecdotally, I'm not seeing a lot of need for special resources because the kids just kind of follow their own paths, and the adults will even tell each other not to put pressure on kids to meet a specific, you know, to follow a specific skill before they're ready, for example. Anecdotally, we're not seeing a lot of need for special provisions.
And I wonder if that too is perhaps linked to what sounds like the range of different teaching strategies that are employed.
Absolutely. Yeah.
This idea about demonstration, about physical action, about sitting and listening to people telling stories. There seems to be a nice mix. So one would imagine that you might respond better to one kind of approach than another.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's multimodal. I mean, everything's happening in concert, right? You go to a part of the forest, you repeat a story a situation that happened there, you track an animal, you come back to camp, you hear another story. So the information's constantly layering on top of itself over and over again. You practice the skills that you're encountering, you encounter the skills that you're practicing. So there's an opportunity to really go deep in a skill and learn from many people as well, which is really important as well. You're learning a variety of ways to solve a problem just by the mere fact that you're learning to, say, collect a tuber with your sister and then with your cousin and then with your aunt and then with your mom and then with your grandma. And everybody has a slightly different strategy. So in that process of seeing how everybody does things, you can also figure out your own way of doing things too.
So is there a tradition then, it seems perhaps there might not be, of perhaps one member of the community passing down a particular technique to two generations younger and then that process being continued in exactly the same way? It sounds like the technology is constantly being updated and reappraised in each generation.
Yeah, absolutely. That's absolutely fine. So there's a big emphasis on reinventing, and that's something one dad told me, is that kids need to make their own stories in their forest. So that really the idea that you have to figure it out, and that's really important in these ecologies because, like we said, like things change and you need to be spry to figuring out that there's been a change, figuring out something has moved, figuring out something's not quite working anymore. And then update your behavior based on that. So people are constantly doing that, constantly updating their knowledge, constantly reinventing, recombining things.
And much of that area of the Congo has been troubled by violence over recent years. How did the communities negotiate that, or was it something they weren't involved in?
So where I work in Republic of the Congo, there hasn't been the civil strife that has happened in Central African Republic and the Democratic Republic of the Congo. So it's a very peaceful part of Central Africa. So that's not really been an issue. There have been Bayaka who've moved down from Central African Republic. The borders are pretty porous, and Bayaka travel in the forest. So who've moved down to the Republic of the Congo to seek refuge during those troubles, but not so much in the area where I work.
Well, that's good to hear. And what further work do you hope to do in the community?
So the project that we're just starting, so I've just booked my flights, I'm going back in June. And we're just starting up a project to look at how kids imitate each other and learn from each other. So the project is really focused on the role of peer learning in different domains of life. And we're going to be interviewing parents about the importance of learning from kids versus adults, and doing some experiments with kids to see who they prefer to imitate, as well as doing some behavioral observations as well. And so we're going to be doing that in Congo with Bayaka foragers and Bandongo farmers, as well as in Scotland and with a Chinese American community in the Seattle area. So I have a great team of collaborators, and we're working together and finalizing some of our measures now. So maybe in a couple of years, I'll come back and let you know what we find. We've just started up. We got the grant. As you can imagine, this research is actually quite expensive because you need a lot of research assistants to make this work. And we've been through the ethical approval process now. And now we're finalizing the measures and getting ready to collect data. So no idea what we'll find yet, but it's fun to have the chance to look at how kids learn from each other in a more quantitative and more structured and targeted way.
Well, it all sounds very exciting. It's great to hear about the work that you and your colleagues have done in this area already. And it's really wonderful to hear some of the stories and the accounts of what practical learning looks like amongst the community. Really, really interesting angle to take on teaching and learning, possibly some lessons for us to think about too in the final part of the show. And I'd like to move on in the final part of the show actually to think about some of the findings of your research and how some of these might inform the educational practice that we currently adopt in Western education systems, if that sounds okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we'll be right back after this.
This show is brought to you in partnership with John Catt Educational, publishing professional development books and resources to support great teaching and learning in schools around the world. Have you checked out their latest releases? Use the code JCTTR2324 for 20% off your order. Don't miss out. Visit johncattbookshop.com to explore their full range of titles and advance your own professional development today. Happy reading.
Welcome back to the final part of our show on teaching and learning in hunter-gatherer societies with Dr. Sheena Lev-Levy. So far, we've considered how education happens in the community and how teachers and learners relate to one another in this context. I wonder if we could conclude, Sheena, by asking whether Western education systems might benefit from embracing any of the strategies that you've observed in the Bayaka community.
Yeah, so I think it's a really interesting question, and I'll start with some caveats. Just like we can't take, you know, a British school and drop it in the middle of a rural community, right? Or even just an urban school and drop it in the middle of a rural community, or, you know, take it abroad. That also works in the other direction. Every community's learning and teaching system is designed for the needs of that community over many generations. And so it's hard to just export in a kind of cookie cutter type of way. But I think we can learn from all the different ways that people learn and grow in different communities all around the world, and ask ourselves if some of our own beliefs about how children learn and grow needs to be revisited as a result of that, especially because education and child development research makes generalizations about human development based actually on a very narrow slice of kids from around the world. And frankly, usually children of university professors tend to be the test subject. So it's not even representative of, you know, the countries as a whole, but they tend to be weird, what we call weird. So an acronym which stands for Western, Educated, Industrialized, Rich, and Democratic, which means that in our research on child development, we know that 94% of studies come from these weird samples. So we're making sweeping generalizations about the world and about how kids learn and grow everywhere based on actually a very unrepresentative sample of kids. So with that in mind, I think there are some things we can definitely learn. The first, I guess, would be that kids are really good at learning. They need a lot less, as long as we have a learning rich environment where there's a lot of input in their environment, they don't need as much guidance as we think that they need in terms of learning. And they're actually capable of doing a lot of things on their own from a very young age. So I think that's like the not even, you know, from an educator, just even me as a parent, because I come from also a very highly schooled background, where I expect, where I, you know, it's hard for me not to constantly intervene in what my kid is doing and ask questions like, oh, well, what do you think of that? And why are you doing this? And sometimes my kid will just say, I don't want to talk right now. He gets tired of the questioning. And that's a really nice opportunity to like, take a step back and let him just kind of do his own thing and work things out without me asking probing, guiding, sometimes irritating questions. So I think that's always like a nice thing that I have to constantly remind myself of. Giving kids a lot of opportunities to work things out in the classroom, I think, amongst themselves. And that's something I've brought into my classroom now that I teach at the university level. We do a lot of discussion, a lot of like think, pair, share kind of style things, because I find that when the students do that, they actually have the opportunity to go deeper into the material and trust themselves more in their learning process. And I try my best to kind of reduce, like, as a researcher, I feel like I know very little about very few things. And by rebalancing who the knowledge holders are within the classroom, it's a nice opportunity to kind of have the students feel more confident in making sense of their lived experience and making sense of their own, you know, participation as community members in the world, and bring that into the classroom and try and figure out together what it means and how it helps us learn more deeply about the material. So I think for me, so those have been the two main lessons. But what do you think? Because you're in the classroom a lot more than I am.
I don't know. I mean, I was initially worried when I was exploring this topic about kind of Lord of the Flies conclusions that we might bring back into our own school. There's a big debate at the moment, obviously, as there has been for, you know, at least 150 years, about the tension between progressive systems of education and traditionalist education methods. And I think the traditionalists are kind of in the ascendancy at the moment in English schools. I wonder how we might be able to develop more opportunities for children to figure things out for themselves when we find ourselves up against, as we heard in our news clip earlier, an education system that seems to approach learning in terms of a new qualification, a new piece of paper to collect, that can then be translated into some kind of value in the marketplace. I wonder what your thoughts were on that.
Yeah. Oh, deep question. other than burning it all down, which I don't, sometimes it feels like, let's just start from scratch. Like, let's do a do-over. I think we need to rethink and we need to be a lot more collaborative. I mean, like you said, every school, every learning community has its own needs, and we can't just be taking, even within the UK, right, like these schools from one place to another. And there needs to be more opportunities. I think teachers are under a lot of pressure to fill content and get certain grades. And if we can just reduce that, where the teachers are collaborators in the classroom, like, just rethink what the role of the teacher is. Collaborators with parents, collaborators in the classroom, and not like truancy specialists or all that kind of stuff. I think that would really change the dynamics, so that then we're part of a community of learners. We're part of a community of people who are trying to work these things out. And that, I think, would be my first thing. Like, let's rethink even what we mean by teacher. Let's rethink what we mean by student. Let's rethink the challenges. So many kids are not going to school right now. And it's a shame that we're putting a lot more pressure on parents, on teachers, on the kids, as opposed to asking, okay, well, why? Like, what are you not getting out of this? What are the challenges that you're facing? Why are you not going to school? Okay, how can we rethink this process to make it better for you? And maybe part of that is having kids have maybe more leadership in school decisions, have that agency in how, even in just decision makings of how resources are spent. That seems like crazy, right? Like a bunch of 10-year-olds deciding where to spend money, but they probably know what the needs are from their point of view. It's the same thing as like kids paying attention to bugs, right? The kids who are going to school know what their school infrastructure or what their classroom learning needs are, because they're at that level, right? They're seeing what the issues are, and that might be something that other people aren't noticing. So just giving that chance for agency and for decision making, I think, could go a long way. But unfortunately, I don't have any good answers.
Now, it's interesting, thinking back to some of the examples you gave in the second part of the show, I wonder too whether the learning processes you've described mean that the student is actually understanding the process by which they arrive at a result. And I sometimes wonder, in the UK, particularly the English education system of which I'm a part, whether we place enough emphasis on students really understanding the processes by which they arrive at an answer or an idea or some kind of breakthrough, because you know, we still have an education system which grades people at the end of the process. And in my own subject, English, in English language, we're going to award fail grades to a third of the national cohort because that's what the qualification requires us to do.
Right.
And I've actually sat down with examination regulators over the past few years, and I've been involved in conversations where we've said amongst the group of the people engaged in the project, how bad does this piece of writing need to be to pass?
Right.
And, you know, how much inaccuracy am I happy with the student demonstrating before they go off into the world of work? So I suppose the kind of focus on the needs of future employers, and is that such a problem in the community you've observed?
I mean, every education system is fit for or is designed for a certain, you know, economy, a certain way of living. I think one of the problems that we face in the UK is that the world of the education system is like from the 1900s and the world of work is not, right? And so there's a lot more problem solving that the kids need to face and need to do. And I don't know if they have as much opportunity to do that. So that's certainly something that comes to mind, is like maybe we should be talking to employers about what their needs are and then thinking about what it would look like to have an education system that matches those needs. I think those conversations are happening, but never quite fast enough, right? And because in the news clip it was talking about like math till 18. Like, yes, maybe that's good. I don't know, but it's not just math, right? It's like reading statistics, understanding statistics of like, what does it mean when we give percentages or means or all of these things? Like, those are real life skills that kids need to have. So is it also that it's good to have some of this content, but are we presenting it in a way that's even transferable to the world? That those kinds of things, sometimes it's even just in the package of the story that we tell to make it relevant to kids.
Yeah, the processes you've described this evening seem to me to balance a need for skills and knowledge within a community. Mm-hmm. And if we look at the UK at the moment, we've got a Scottish education system which is predominantly governed by skills learning. Mm-hmm. And we've got an English and Welsh education system, well, less so in Wales perhaps, but an English education system which is largely focused on knowledge. And you're going to get, of course, Scottish students and English students both turning up at the University of Durham to start undergraduate courses. Mm-hmm. What do you notice when they arrive?
I haven't been teaching long enough to really be able to tell the difference. And frankly, I'm not, there's so much variation in UK accents that I'm still figuring out where people are from, really. So it's hard for me to say. It'd be interesting to hear from the students themselves of how adjusted and they feel and how much they feel their A-levels or their secondary experiences has prepared them for university. So maybe I'll start asking. It's a good question.
Well, I think we're never going to resolve this one in the next 20 minutes. So we better wrap it up here. It's an excellent point on which to bring tonight's show to a close. So Sheena, thank you for sharing your research, expertise and imagination with us this evening. I feel considerably more knowledgeable on what education is and could be as a result of our conversation. If only we could summon up the imagination to look beyond international ranking tables, arguments about the needs of future employers, and possibly ideological debates about the role of the learner. It's been truly fascinating, too, to hear your accounts of educational practices that seem to foster community spirit through collaboration rather than competition. Perhaps we could try bringing a little more of this same ethic to our schools and colleges in the year ahead. Thank you very much for your contributions and for finding the time to speak to us this evening.
And thank you so much for having me. It was a really nice conversation.
Thank you, and have a good night.
Thank you, you too.
This show is brought to you in partnership with John Catt Educational, publishing professional development books and resources to support great teaching and learning in schools around the world. Have you checked out their latest releases? Use the code JCTTR2324 for 20% off your order. Don't miss out. Visit johncattbookshop.com to explore their full range of titles and advance your own professional development today. Happy reading.
So, dear listener, this brings us to the end of another Sunday Late Show. I hope you found this evening's show as illuminating as I did. Thanks again to Dr. Sheena Levy for her thoughts on teaching, learning, and the purpose of education in the Bayaka community. And thanks to everyone who has tuned in tonight. Do check out our other Teachers Talk radio shows this week. We have a number of new hosts continuing to make their debuts. So look up the schedule on the website and give them a listen if you can. I'm sure they'd appreciate your support and in-show text messages. Hannah Wilson will be talking about learning walkthroughs with Tom Sherrington at 7:30 p.m. on Tuesday, which promises to be an excellent show on Western classroom practice. As always, you can listen to anything you've missed with our excellent and ever-growing panel of teacher presenters at www.ttradio.org. So you can catch Tom Rogers interviewing Shadow Education Secretary Bridget Phillipson about Labour's developing education policy agenda. Emily Edwards reflecting upon questions that no history teacher wants to hear uttered in their classroom. And Ray exploring the reality of life as a pastoral responsibility holder. All of these shows and more are readily accessible via the Listen Back service on our website. And if you have something you want to say or ask others about education anywhere on planet Earth, then perhaps you should consider applying to join the station as a show host. We are always on the lookout for those with current or recent experience of the classroom and other less familiar educational settings. Full details can be found on our website, www.ttradio.org. That's all from me for this month. So thank you for listening. I wish you a peaceful Easter holiday if your holiday has already commenced. And we will speak again in October. Thank you and goodbye.
You've been listening to Teachers Talk Radio. Tune in live and listen back at ttradio.org. We look forward to hearing from you next time on Teachers Talk Radio.